Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Chris French. He's emeritus professor and head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit in the Psychology Department at Goldsmith University of London. And we're talking about his book, The Science of Weird Shit, Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal. Chris, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, Mark.
First of all, how could I resist the title? I saw that I had to read this book.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
I had to read this book, The Science of Weird Shit. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it started off as a joke. I mean, initially.
Oh, this is a this is a deeply serious book.
Well, yeah, it is. It is, and I hope people don't get. I hope some people at least don't get put off by thinking, "Oh, that looks like you know, a little bit of trivia," you know, and ignoring it because it is meant to be a serious book.
Well, it ends up
jokes in it.
Oh, there's a lot of jokes in it. We'll talk about some of them. But it ends up being a book about how we perceive the world, how we think about the world, and how that information is processed by our brain. And that's one of the sort of sub-themes of this book, and it's really interesting stuff. How did you first get interested in the so-called paranormal?
Well, as a kid, I believed in a lot of this stuff. As a kid, I was absolutely terrified of ghosts. You know, I kind of had a nightlight for a lot longer than most kids. and then even kind of going through teenage years, I was always just kind of fascinated by this stuff. You know, there were programs or books about UFOs and ghosts and so on. That stuff always fascinated me. And really, well into early adulthood, I still would have classed myself as a believer in the paranormal. And then someone recommended a book when I was doing my PhD, which is in a completely different topic. Someone recommended a book called Parapsychology, Science or Magic, by a Canadian social psychologist called James Alcock. Hmm. And it was the first skeptical treatment of all this stuff that I'd ever read, and gave, you know, not only did I enjoy the book immensely, it also, I found it very persuasive. You know, the explanations that he was putting forward for the weird experiences that people have made a lot of sense to me, and that's really what sparked my whole interest in a kind of skeptical approach towards the paranormal. So I still find it fascinating, but now it's from a different perspective. It's seeing if we can explain those weird experiences in psychological terms.
Other influences, and I know these people in journals. There's a great journal called The Skeptic Inquirer. James, the amazing Randi, who I remember when he was just a magician, but he devoted the greater part of his adult life to debunking and looking into paranormal claims. And then there's people like Dr. Susan Blackmore. What is PSICOP, C-S-I-C-O-P?
That stands for the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. And that was set up in the mid-70s by kind of some very big hitters. You know, some of the early people that were involved included people like James Randi, Carl Sagan, Isaac Asimov, you know, lots of other kind of really big names. And there was a kind of concern then that there seemed to be a kind of a rising tide of belief in various New Age practices and other, you know, woo ideas, if you like. and this organization was set up in response to that. It has now kind of, it's more recently changed its name. It's now CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Investigation.
It sounds like one of those television programs.
Yeah, exactly. Not to say, not to be confused with the TV series. But it's still kind of, it's also changed insofar as its kind of remit, if you like, has widened. Back in the 70s, it was pretty much solely focused on kind of paranormal and very closely related claims, whereas now it covers kind of political issues, belief in conspiracy theories, a much wider range, religion even. You know, we used to kind of really avoid talking about religious beliefs, but I think people are more willing to talk about that stuff now.
Well, especially in this,
that's a good thing.
I think especially in this day and age, these conspiracy theories have really risen to that level of bizarre phenomena.
you know, I mean, I think in some people's eyes, a lot of people probably think of fake news as being a relatively recent phenomenon, but I mean, it really wasn't. You know, back in the 70s, this is what people like Psykov were battling against. You know, ideas are put around, claim to be true, and just aren't supported by the evidence, and can often be kind of very dangerous and very damaging. And we really see that with some of the unfounded conspiracy theories that are doing the rounds these days.
Oh my God, I mean, it's happening here in the United States with Haitians eating cats and dogs.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it doesn't really matter kind of how outrageous and almost ridiculous the claims would be. They'd almost be comical if it wasn't that they have real-life negative consequences for people. I mean, you look at some of the claims of groups like, you know, QAnon.
Oh, God,
you know,
yeah.
The idea that there's a kind of satanic conspiracy and there's children are being kind of devised and eaten and paedophilia and so on.
And there's lizard people mixed up in it.
Yeah, it's really, well, I think what's happened, and I think it's fair to say that there aren't that many people who totally buy into the beliefs of, you know, QAnon-type beliefs. People kind of buy into parts of it, you know, the idea that there are shady groups behind the scenes pulling the strings. And let's face it, to some extent, there is some truth in that. You know, I think we can all accept that there are vested interests that are, you know, working things to their own advantage. But the notion that there's this kind of, yeah, I mean, typically it's described as being kind of Jews and New World Order and all that. It's very anti-Semitic.
That's very old.
Yeah, that goes.
But this is new stuff, and it's affecting political elections like it isn't here in the United States. Now, what's the term anomalistic psychology?
Right. I mean, the way that basically it's the psychology of weird stuff, if you like. I mean, to put it very, very crudely. People used to ask me what my area of research was, and I'd say it was the psychology of ostensibly paranormal experiences and related beliefs, which was a bit of a mouthful, you know. And so I was looking around for an alternative, concise phrase that I could use. Anomalistic psychology, I didn't invent it; it was already around. But I thought that's the phrase I want. So that when people ask me, I could just say, oh, yeah, I do anomalistic psychology. But inevitably, they then say, what the hell is anomalistic psychology? So it didn't really solve the problem.
Well, is there a clear definition of paranormal?
Well, again, this is one of those things that there's a whole chapter in the book, which or a chunk of a chapter devoted to that very issue, because it sounds like one of those words that we all know what it means, but actually it's hard to put a precise definition on it, and it does depend who you ask. If you ask a parapsychologist, you know, there aren't very many parapsychologists in the world, but they are there are a few dozen at different universities around the world, and they tend to have quite a strict definition of what they believe, you know, comes under their definition of the paranormal. Covers basically ESP, extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, or PK, and evidence relating to life after death, and that's it. Whereas an anomalistic psychologist, as well as the mass media, tend to go for a much wider, looser definition of anything weird and wonderful. So that would include things like Bigfoot, the Bermuda Triangle, astrology, all of those things wouldn't come under that stricter definition.
There's a list in your book that's amazing, because it's like fairies and zombies. Are they on the list?
Well, this is it, yes. The reason I put that list together was to just get people thinking about, okay, so how would I define it? Would I include that in, or would I not include that in? And again, it's an exercise I used to do with my students at Goldsmiths when I did a course on this stuff. And it would really get them thinking about, like, yeah, okay, so what exactly do we mean? I mean, for me, there's no perfect definition, but a good working definition of paranormal would be some phenomena that cannot be explained in terms of currently accepted scientific concepts. I think that pretty much covers the ground. But, yeah, even that's not perfect.
I noticed that déjà vu is listed twice.
Yeah, it's an old joke. Who's not going to use it just because it's old? You know?
The Department of Deja Vu Department. So, You know, again, people listening to this going, well, you know, we talked about what the harm is. You know, people may think, you know, what's the harm in believing in fairies? What's the harm in believing in zombies? My problem with it is critical thinking. We seem to have lost some of the rigor of critical thinking. And I don't know whether it's because people don't read or is it because of the internet is spreading this information so wide and far. But there is a harm to this. I mean, you need to question things. You need to think about things in a critical way, and then it makes you a better person.
I think that's right. I mean, for me, the kind of, you know, when people say, what is a skeptic? I mean, the answer for me would be, it's someone who just says, well, show me the evidence. You know,
there's nothing wrong with that. That's like that should be a starting point.
Absolutely. You know, but I mean, there are so many people around who don't really seem to care what the evidence says, you know, as long as
I mean,
you talked about American politics earlier. You can see it, American political scene with, you know, I mean, Donald Trump can just come out with lie after lie after lie, and his fan base just lap it up. They don't really care that he's lying.
I find that wild. I don't understand it.
Well, again, there's a lot of social scientists around the world also trying to figure it out. I think, you know, there's a government that made some progress on it. There's this notion that, I mean, a lot of it is about tribalism, obviously.
Once you
have nailed your colors to the mast, you are showing just how good a Republican you are, how good a Trumpster you are, if you accept the most ridiculous things that he says, because that's a kind of, you know, very overt kind of symbol of how loyal you are, you know, that you can even accept this nonsense. But you know, for somebody like myself, and I think like yourself, who's interested in things like evidence and the truth,
right,
you know, then it's very hard to kind of get your head around it.
Well, let's give an example. At the very beginning of your book, you have a whole chapter on sleep paralysis, and it's amazing where the discussion of that went in your book. And it's a good example of what your book is about. First of all, let's define sleep paralysis.
Sure, yeah. It's a fairly common phenomenon. There'll be lots of your listeners who will have experienced it. In its most basic form, it's what it says on the tin. It's a temporary period of paralysis that occurs between sleep and wakefulness. So either as you're just drifting off into sleep or as you're just coming out of sleep, you realize you can't move. It typically lasts a few seconds and you snap out of it. And if that's all you get, most people would find that a little bit disconcerting, but nothing too much to worry about. However, it can be associated with a range of other symptoms that can make it absolutely terrifying. And they include things like a very strong sense of presence. So even if you can't see or hear anything else in the room with you, you're just sure that there is. You've got a very strong feeling that there is something or someone there, and they mean you no good whatsoever. And, of course, you can't move, so it's doubly terrifying.
Are these panic attacks?
No, it's not quite the same as a panic attack, although it's very similar, and it'd be very easy to confuse the two. I mean, mostly with panic attacks, you are not paralyzed. It'd be the main difference here. The other thing is that with sleep paralysis, you can also get vivid hallucinations in any sensory modality, either auditory, visual, or tactile, anything. So you can see things and hear things that aren't there, typically very scary things like monsters, demons, other
right,
hags,
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
It's like reports of incubus in your sleep. And you have it in your book. There's a great Fuseli's print of the nightmare where this person's asleep and there's this weird demon sitting on their chest is a good example of sleep paralysis.
That's right. I mean, it's a perfect depiction. I mean, it's one of my favorite pictures. I mean, you've got this woman who's lying there on her back, kind of hanging off the edge of a chaise longue, and there's a demon on her chest, you say, and there's a weird horse peering through the drapes. It's all very surreal. But it is a perfect depiction of sleep paralysis. And that sense of pressure on the chest, it leads to people feeling as if they're being strangled or suffocated. And again, you know, obviously adds to the terror of the whole experience. If you do have the underlying susceptibility to sleep paralysis, you are much more likely to actually have an episode if you sleep on your back than any other position.
Huh.
But you can understand, certainly in an era where virtually everyone believed in spirits, demons, goblins, etc., that these experiences would be interpreted in those terms. And they still are by a lot of people and all around the world, and they have been for centuries.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Chris French, the Emeritus Professor and Head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit in the Psychology Department of Goldsmiths, University of London. And we're talking about his book. It is a really good, it's an amazing read. And it takes you in a lot of different places. The Science of Weird Shit, Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal. Chris, when you talk about the symptoms of sleep paralysis, it seems reminiscent of certain kinds of reports of things like ghosts and maybe even out-of-body experiences.
It can turn into a full-blown out-of-body experience. I mean, there's what you seem to have is a kind of common core, which is the paralysis. And some of these other symptoms. But there can be a lot of variation. I mean, people will sometimes report that they, for example, feel as if they're being kind of dragged out of the bed and maybe down into the floor. And as I say, sometimes it will turn into a full-blown out-of-body experience. So it's interesting all the way these things all kind of link up, because there's a whole, you know, area of research into the psychology of out-of-body experiences, which can obviously occur in other contexts as well, such as near-death experiences, or just spontaneously people can sometimes have an out-of-body experience just totally out of the blue, you know, maybe when they're driving down the motorway.
Yep.
Which can, you know, be a bit worrying, but there you go. It does happen.
Well, it strikes me that the challenge of sleep paralysis is here you have a phenomena that doesn't occur that often. Okay, it does occur, but it doesn't occur that often. How can we study things like that scientifically?
It's a very, very good question. I mean, there's two kind of main approaches. One is the approach that we have tended to take in our own research on the topic, which is basically just getting people to fill in questionnaires to give us details. Have you ever had sleep paralysis? What were the symptoms? You know, how did you try to cope with it? What strategies do you adopt to try to avoid it, and so on and so forth? And that's useful. As you will have gathered from reading the book, I also love getting sent those first-hand experiences from people. Now, again, one thing to bear in mind there is that these are people who have themselves decided that what is happening to them is sleep paralysis. They haven't gone down the route of thinking it was a demon, or it was a ghost, or it was aliens. They themselves have decided it was a hallucinatory experience, because, of course, all of those other people who think that it's a genuine paranormal phenomenon, they're going to turn to others, not to me, because they know that, you know, I think it's a psychological thing. But that's one approach. And as I say, you can get some very, very useful data. But what would be great, of course, is to actually study it in the sleep laboratory.
Chris, I have to tell you, I was in a sleep laboratory once. And I don't. First of all, I don't understand how people can sleep in that situation. I'm a light sleeper, and I had wires hooked up not only to my head but around my body and around private parts, and you know, there's red lights on, and even though they darken the room and they try to make it look like a cheesy motel room, it doesn't work. So I'm skeptical of most sleep studies, because anybody that can sleep through that is amazing. I don't know. I think if we could have some kind of psychoactive drug that would simulate sleep paralysis, then I think we're talking. But these dream laboratory things, oh my God.
I've never actually done that kind of research myself. One of the reasons is,
oh my God,
you need all that expensive equipment.
You do.
Also, I think you need somebody who's actually going to be willing to stay up all night watching those monitors and so on and so forth. And
oh my God,
I'm not going to do that.
It was the worst night's sleep I ever had my entire life. This brings up another really crucial point in your book that I thought was one of those chapters that everybody should read, and that's about the fallibility of memory. that we're reporting these phenomena and our memory and remembering of what we actually experienced is really, really sort of fragile and very malleable.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting, you know, bits of trivia is that the very first systematic study of the unreliability of eyewitness testimony took place in the context of a fake seance back in the Victorian era. A guy called S.J. Davy, who'd been to lots of seances and was initially convinced by what he saw. He thought it genuinely was the work of spirits. And then he realized it was all done by trickery. So he practiced the tricks himself, put on his own seance, but he got the sitters to all write down in as much detail as possible and as accurately as possible what they had experienced. And what he found was that the accounts they came up with were so radically different from what had actually taken place that you wouldn't have been able to explain what was happening in kind of non-paranormal terms. But that was because the accounts were not accurate. People misremembered the order of events, who was present, whether items had been touched, etc., etc. And I think that's a kind of sobering lesson. And that kind of thing has been shown in many, many other studies since then, you know, including some of the stuff that we carried out, some of the experiments we published ourselves. And the other aspect that I'm very interested in, of course, is the psychology of false memories, not just distorted memories for something you did witness, but entirely false memories for things that just never happened at all. And it really does kind of makes you realize just how untrustworthy your memory can be.
And by the way, I want to mention your book is fully annotated and footnoted, and you mentioned many, many experiments that people can look up. But one of the things was that sort of mania that there were satanic people kidnapping kids, and people will have remembered being kidnapped, and different psychologists will have them retrieve forgotten memories, and that whole thing is totally suspect.
It's absolutely totally suspect. I mean, the techniques that are used with the best of intentions. I mean, these are not done. It's not been done by people who are kind of in any way bad people. They genuinely believe that there is a satanic scare, you know, that there are Satan worshippers around the world and that children are often the victims. But that because they believe in the concept of repression, the idea that when you suffer something really traumatic, the memory of it is pushed down into an unconscious part of the mind where you just cannot regain it no matter how hard you try. But they believe that you can pull up these memories. If in therapy, for example, they believe that a lot of adult psychological problems are caused by these repressed memories. Well, I should say there is no evidence that repression really happens like that at all. But if you buy into that idea that the only way that you can help someone to get over their psychological problems is by recovering these memories, you might employ techniques like hypnotic regression, for example.
Right.
And a lot of people, a lot of the general public think that, oh, yeah, you can use hypnosis to make people go back mentally in time and, you know, relive events and so on. And it's just not true. In fact, it provides a really good context for the formation of false memories based on your own expectations and, you know, little bits and pieces of information that you've picked up maybe from films or books or newspaper, magazines, whatever, and it's all woven together, and then it feels like a very, very compelling, real memory, just as real as any other memory in your head. And yet, for me, it's important that people realize that the same techniques are used, whether you're talking about recovering memories of alleged childhood sexual abuse, because we know that that does happen. That's a real phenomenon. It can be devastating. But it's the same techniques that are used there as are also used to recover allegedly hidden memories of alien abduction.
Right.
Past life memories.
Right.
It's the same techniques.
And people's lives are affected by this, the results of this. That's important to always keep in mind, that there are people's lives. And the alien abduction thing is just amazing, because there's now a general idea of what an alien looks like for the public. And it's just amazing how many of the aliens all look like the gray, dark-eyed things.
That's right. Yeah, there are a couple of other kind of variations on that, but it's interesting. I mean, that, what you can do here is you can trace it back in time, and you realise that, you know, if you go back a few decades, there was much more variation. You know, people have always claimed they had these kind of contact with weird creatures, but it became around about the kind of 80s, 90s, where that idea of the grey, as we call
that's
it,
right.
You know,
that's
the big
right.
black eyes, that became the kind of standard now. That's the one you see in the cartoons, in the graffiti. You know, that's our idea now of an alien. But before that, there was much more variation. So you can see it's a kind of, it's a cultural phenomenon. It's a part of our general cultural beliefs rather than a real objective phenomenon.
We're completely out of time. And we've only like talked about the first two chapters in the book, first two or three chapters. And the book goes on, and there's so much information in this book. My guest tonight has been Chris French. He's emeritus professor and head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit in the Psychology Department of Goldsmiths University in London. And we've been talking about his book. It is really a good and important read, The Science of Weird Shit, Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal. Chris, it's been a pleasure.
I've enjoyed it immensely.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.